This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Grasso with the Indie Spirituals Podcast on the Be Here Now Network, and my guest, soon-to-be good friend, Steve-O, is joining me today. Steve-O, how are you, man?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thank you.
You know what, maybe I'm anxious, I'm irritable today, I don't know what it is, man, I have no excuse, but I'm irritable and discontent in general, and call it alcoholism. I don't know, but I feel compelled to be honest.
And I really appreciate that. Maybe we can do something about that in this conversation. I don't know. But I hear you, man. I taught a day workshop today with teenagers, and that's very stressful, and came home, and now I'm doing this, which I wouldn't rather be doing anything else. But thank you for the honesty. That's what this show is all about, man. So I'm going to read your bio real quick for our listeners, and then we're going to hop into this thing. Steve-O, a.k.a. Stephen Glover, was willing to do whatever it took to become famous, even if it meant stapling his ball sack to his leg. After failing miserably at the University of Miami, Steve-O was a homeless couch surfer for 3 years before he attended Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Clown College to help future his goal of becoming a famous stuntman. Eventually, Steve-O's videos made it into the hands of Jeff Tremaine, Jackass's creator, director, producer, who was also working with Johnny Knoxville at the time, and the rest is history. Since then, Steve-O has become a New York Times bestselling author, established himself as a force in the world of comedy, has tons of big social media platforms, is engaged to a wonderful woman named Lux, who they are planning to start an animal sanctuary together. Most importantly, Steve-O has been clean and sober since March of 2008. And lives a surprisingly healthy lifestyle with his fiance Lux in Los Angeles. Thank you. There was so much more, but I wanted to get the bullet points out.
Right. Yeah, that was definitely. It's funny. I watched your podcast with Neil Donald Walsh, who I'm such a huge fan of.
Yeah.
And he really recoiled at his bio. He said, "Man, I've got to." That, you know, I've got to get somebody to change that, you know, was awful.
So I took it off your website. I cut it down as much as I
sure,
could.
Sure, yeah.
But yeah.
You could have cut it down way more. I would have been happy with it.
Well, all right. I just wanted to get some of, maybe it was selfish, some of the things I enjoy about you out there. But yes, speaking of Neil Donald Walsh, we've connected through a mutual friend, Liz Dawn Donahue, and I've spoken at her conferences. That's part of what I do. And I remember seeing a picture she had posted that you were at one of them. I was like, holy shit, you know, Steve Ozer, that's really cool. So, you know, it's funny to me that here are two guys that grew up on punk rock and skateboarding and complete debauchery. I couldn't imagine myself when I was younger going to a spiritual conference, quote unquote spiritual, let alone speaking at one, and writing books about that shit and recovery and what I'm doing today. But here I am. So I'm interested, what led you to the Celebrate Your Life conference and Neil's work and anybody else in that field?
It was just Neil. Okay. You know, I read Conversations with God, book one. Somebody gave it to me before I got sober, and I didn't touch it. And then when I was a little over 1 year sober, maybe I actually started it sooner than that, I read it in early sobriety.
Yeah.
And I don't think I was ready for it at that time because I still had so much shame, so much guilt. I really had this just deep problem with who I was. And then in 2017, I read it and I reread it.
Yeah.
And it just connected with, I was just like, whoa, you know, like it profoundly changed the way I view life and the world. And I really loved that. And then I read book two and then book three. I read all three of them. I know there's four now.
Right.
But I haven't read the fourth. You know, I just loved it. And when I got to the end of two or three, it said connect with me on my website. Yeah. So I went on to Neil's website. And when I went on to Neil's website, it was I'll be at this. And I was like, dude, he's going to be there. Like, let's go. Let's go meet him. So we booked trips. We booked flights, to my buddy and I, to Chicago, to the Celebrate Your Life. And then it turned out that same weekend in Chicago, there was a big UFC event, an Ultimate Fighting. And I'm a huge fan of the UFC, mixed martial arts. And so it was just this weird thing that we were there. I reached out to the UFC president, Dana White, and asked him, and I said, oh, I'll be there. He gave us front row tickets. I was so excited. And that was the same day that we went to listen to Neil talk.
Yeah.
So we go and Neil has two questions and I raised my hand. Asked him, I had so many questions, even written down. I couldn't ask them all, but I definitely said to him that, it's kind of weird. In conversations with God, it describes that highly evolved beings would never structure an activity such that one individual benefits from the demise or whatever, at the expense of another.
Yeah.
They just wouldn't, highly evolved beings wouldn't do it. They wouldn't set it up so one comes out on top at the expense of the other. And I said, so that just seems to me to rule out sports in general. Mm. And should I feel bad about sports? And then let me take it another step further, that tonight we're going to be at the UFC watching people really, and I'm conflicted about that. Neil said that sports are okay. So it's okay to love sports.
Good.
And he also indicated that while he personally wouldn't have any interest in UFC, he wasn't sure about the UFC, but it was not lost on him that going from Celebrate Your Life to the UFC direct was an odd choice. And the whole conference itself was really it was overwhelmingly female.
Yes.
And it was a certain type of lady. we definitely, my buddy and I stuck out like sore thumbs, but it was just so cool to meet Neil and to get our picture taken with him.
Yeah.
And this will come off as a weird thing, and it's probably alienating people who don't even know Neil or his work. And I know that his books are very polarizing.
Sure.
Because you have to it's a little bit of a pill to swallow. You have to it's a guy having a conversation with God, and he's writing both, both sides of the dialogue.
Right.
And it's a lot to wrap your head around. But what helps wrapping your head around it is that book one of Conversations with God was on the New York Times bestseller list for a record, 130 something weeks, almost 3 years.
Yeah.
And I think it holds a record for that. So while it's tough to wrap your head around, it does lend credibility. And I just think it's fascinating. And just I'll get off the Neil Donald Walsh. But I felt that he, what I described in the beginning of the call, I feel irritable, I feel anxious, and then already that's come down a bit. But I felt Neil was having one of those days. He was felt seemed a little irritable, and
yeah, yeah.
you know, and to see him, but like, I think I was like overwhelming, like, oh man, I'm so excited. And he's like, okay, all right. You know, like he wasn't like really thrilled with my fanfare. And I think he found me kind of annoying, and it really humanized him for me. You know, I was like, oh, okay, so he is like a regular guy. Like, he's just a regular guy. He gets annoyed. He gets like a, you know, and to me that lent credibility to his books, because it just didn't seem like this guy was
right.
Was the voice of God, and the, you know,
there he
it
is.
It separated him.
Yeah.
So, he just didn't seem to enjoy meeting me at all, and I was like, yeah, man, you know. But then again, like the you know, he's just a guy, and his books are fucking awesome. So
I certainly.
All right. So yeah, let's move on from there, and apologies to the listeners who. Just aren't that's not their jam.
Well, if they're listening to the podcast, we cover like all bases, so if it's not their jam, then they can deal with that. But I had dinner with Neil the first Celebrate Your Life I presented at, and I just remember he looked so confused, you know, because you were at the conference. I don't look like someone that's going to be presenting in front of 2,000 people at that conference, and I'm there. I am. They have the presenter's dinner, I think, the second night, and I'm at a table with Neil and Bruce Lipton and a couple other people, and really, like, they're looking at me like, what the fuck is going on? Like, but they were really kind, and I appreciated that. But yeah, it was weird for me, man. Like,
and weird to see them eating meat.
Yeah. Oh yes. A lot
like, what the fuck are they doing eating meat?
Yes.
That's another thing that it was like, you know, but then again, Neil will say in his books, like, you know, hey, like, I don't necessarily do everything that, you know, it says in the book.
Yes, no, absolutely. And seeing that humanity is helpful, like you said, because they're humans too. They're fallible. You know, they're teachers and they've walked a path, but they still fuck up because they're humans. It's just what it is. So
right.
Have you had a chance? And we won't move on, but I've met people where I really was excited to meet them, and I've had that ugh moment. Have you seen them again or anything, or was that it for you?
That's just the only time I met him.
Okay. Well, hopefully it gets better or you meet him again. I don't know.
Right.
Let's talk about, so I don't want to talk about shit you always talk about. Let's talk about, right. Let's talk about punk rock. All right.
Okay.
Do you,
for
you get
sure.
to talk about punk often?
Yeah. You know what? I don't want you to feel like nervous, you know, but like, by all means, throw me whatever you got. It's all right. All good.
No, these are things I love. So we share punk so rock. Many passions.
Punk rock is great. So, and I like, just as it relates to music in general, like, always found myself feeling very uncomfortable, like, in my skin, like, with who I was. And I sought to, like, just identify with something. Like, at first it was Little League sports.
Sure.
You know? And it's like, you know, I wasn't enough, but somehow when I put on my game uniform, my first team was the Orioles, and it was this orange, like, I think I was in like second or third grade. And, you know, I was just this little kid, and like, you know, when I put on that baseball uniform, like, now I was a baseball player, you know, like, yeah. It just, like, I felt like it made me, you know, it was just like, it was like a uniform, like, really, it helped. And, like, there's this, I have this Canadian citizenship card I took a photo for when I was 8 or 9. And, no, I would have been 8. And, you know, I'm wearing, like, I went to go get my photo taken for this Canadian citizenship card, like a passport photo. And I felt compelled to be wearing my football uniform, full pads,
right.
full shoulder pads, like the whole deal. And, you know, like, I'm a football player. Like, I would wear my baseball uniform, like, to the movie theater. Like, if I was going to go see, like, a movie with a friend, it's like, I would show up because, like, it made me feel like I wasn't enough without it. And right. then the skate, the you know, Little League baseball, then my uniform became like heavy metal. You know, I would try to grow my mullet, and, you know, as long as my parents would let me have it.
Sure.
Like, I would, you know, with the jean jacket, with the patches and the heavy metal bands, and, like, the, you know, that was my identity. And you know, kids in fifth grade would tell me to call me like a Satan worshiper, you know, and that would like really hurt my feelings, you know. And then it became skateboarding, which is his identity. And then after the skateboarding, it became the being a pothead, you know, like, right. But I always just went and went overboard, like identifying with some kind of thing. And when I was in my whole skateboarding, there was a while, a very brief moment when I was 15 years old that I had X's on my hands, like straight edge.
Oh, yeah.
There's some pictures of me skating with X's on my hands, like, nice. You know, like doing a handrail, like, you know, like even kick flipping down some stairs. But so, yeah, like I went from heavy metal to skateboarding. And in that move, like the whole identity of like heavy metal and then skateboarding. But then I kind of ditched the heavy metal music for hardcore punk.
Yeah, it was kind of weird to balance those two back in the day. Today it's natural, but yeah, I remember.
Right. Like, I just somehow, you know, like it just did, you know, I went to like Misfits. Like I really loved the Misfits,
yeah.
And you know, 7 Seconds and Youth Brigade, what was, Suicidal Tendencies, you know, a lot, that was like that whole kind of, I mean, I guess that's a pretty wide range of hardcore music. But then I got really into like Gorilla Biscuits, all that straight edge stuff.
Yep. That's rad. I'm friends with Gavin. He's a good friend of mine from Gorilla Biscuits and Burn and all those New York hardcore bands. And I know we have John Joseph in common and a lot of good
for
people.
Sure.
Yeah, which is super cool.
You said Gavin. Is he the guy who is involved with the Crossroads Kitchen in LA, the vegan restaurant?
No, he's in New York. But okay. If you remember Gorilla Biscuits, Burn, like all of these bands, Shelter, they all had like revolving members constantly. You know, it's like
right. They
were all just trading bands. So I'm not sure who that member is that's in LA. But yeah, Gavin's still in New York, but great guy.
Okay.
Good dude.
Sib's out in New York doing tattoos.
He is. Speaking of tattoos, you're doing tattoos, right? How's that going?
I haven't done one in a while. We've got this whole shutdown thing going on. But yeah, I'm excited about it, man. Like, I don't know what it is, but it just like as soon as I did a tattoo, I was like, fuck yeah, man! Like, that's good. I did a good job. Like, then all of a sudden, I wanted to do it more and more.
I love that. Are you? You're not apprenticing though, right? Are you just like going for it?
I am.
Oh, you are. Okay.
Yeah, I don't like to tattoo without my guy. It's a pretty informal apprenticeship.
Sure.
But. But yeah, I don't like to do a tattoo without my guy there, like just making sure everything is kind of by the books as far as safety goes, and that he can give me tips on how to do it, because I've tried a couple without him there, and it wasn't a good experience.
Understood.
And when he is there, it's generally a really pretty good experience. But
cool. So I didn't mean to skip off of punk so quick because I think...
Oh, yeah, it's all good, man. I don't mind. I just don't know, like, how much, you know, as deep as you want to go.
What I was going to ask, because I like the uniform, you know, kind of concept you were talking about. And,
yeah.
You know, we all have these, like, uniforms we wear in one regard or another. Maslow's hierarchy of needs is being accepted by others and fitting in. And for me, you know, when I found punk, I had the seed planted when I was like 8. I watched the Public Domain video from Paul Peralta, and I remember Weakness from McRad was on there, and I didn't know what punk was. I was a kid, and I heard that, and I was just like, holy shit. So I didn't listen to it for a while, but as I got deeper into skateboarding, you know, then I started going to shows, and Snapcase and all these other bands, and the bands you mentioned, I fell in love with them. It was super cool. And then Chuck Treese was in McRad. I don't know if you've crossed paths with him. Great skateboarder. Really good dude. Well, yeah. So anyways, I don't know where I was going with Chuck, but what I remember about the punk thing was it was the first time for me I found some semblance of like feeling like not such a outcast, not such a weirdo. Was that anything that you experienced, or were you just in it like call to the music? I mean, I still feel like a weirdo, so I don't know, like, but.
Yeah, I felt like a weirdo no matter what. Like, by the... Yeah. I don't know that anything ever made me not feel like a weirdo.
I don't think I'd expect a different answer. That's certainly fair enough. So from punk, which gave you like, you know, this, or you felt like the connected or whatever, and you had skateboarding in your life, and then you started, you were doing stunts, continued doing stunts, and I don't want to go way deep into that, but how are you feeling today, like doing those? I know Jackass 4 is kind of in production, and I'm guessing you can't talk about that, but I know that's how you live your life. You never have slowed down, I don't think. You know, you're doing tours, you're...
My concern is just how much longer I can get away with it, you know? Like, my body feels reasonably good. I mean, there's certain stuff... skateboarding isn't like as attractive to me anymore. It's like, you know, definitely harder to push myself at skating.
Yeah.
I would be hard pressed to really get a full rotation on a standing backflip on flat ground.
Right.
So I find myself like my physical abilities are. There are already limitations based on my age, but I think that as far as like kind of jackass stunts go, like a lot of skill and you know talent or you know coordinate like physical like prowess like isn't necessarily required to kind of throw your body into peril.
Right.
So I honestly think that physical limitations like are minor and don't really pertain to the continuation of physicality. But there is definitely, you know, even more than anything, I feel like there's a concern that at a certain point it just gets creepy to watch a middle-aged guy do that. I mean, I don't know. There's been different people feel different ways. My buddy Johnny Knoxville thinks it just gets funnier. The older we get, there's certainly, you know, I think there's people are interested in seeing it. And like, I love doing it, man. You know, and no matter how much spiritual growth, no matter how much sobriety, no matter how much I really work on being a good guy,
yeah,
I'm just always going to be an attention whore, and I can't, you know, I can't change that.
I appreciate that. I mean, you know, I too am in recovery and do the spiritual thing, and I have to honor like my awkwardness. I'm like I said earlier, I'm a weirdo. I love metal. I love hip hop. I write for Fangoria, you know, like the premier horror magazine.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just, it's who I am, but it doesn't make me feel like I'm not doing well in my healing journey. So that makes me, you know, think today, I mentioned I did a workshop earlier with teenagers. I do one every week. They're residential, 13 to 18. They're not just there for addiction. They're there for self-harm, suicide attempts, things of that nature. And I try to tell them, you know, like, if once you get sober, once you embark on the healing journey, life can be rad. It can still be a lot of fun. It doesn't have to be like this mundane, terrible thing that a lot of younger people kind of think it's going to be. So, you know, you're saying like you still have this part of you, you know, you still have fun. You still are living your life. If you were in a room with a bunch of teenagers like that were in that situation, what would you say to them?
Like, are you asking like how would I carry the message?
Yeah, essentially. And not just like, again, drugs or alcohol, but those that, you know, some are there just strictly for suicide attempts or self-harm, depression, just being a younger person that is having trouble seeing, you know, their future ahead of them without that in their life.
I mean, I think that it's tough for me to address issues that that I don't relate to, and not to say that I don't relate to depression or, you know, But there just are certain like kind of mental illness things that I just don't feel like qualified or, you know, that it's appropriate for me to weigh in on.
Sure.
I think that it's in a very general sense, like it's worth pointing out that there is no school of thought, there is no religion, there is no wisdom that suggests life is not to be enjoyed. You know, I think that that's a good starting point for just everybody. Okay, let me just stop and think, you know, that clearly, if for no other reason, I am here to enjoy this life. Now, that is, I think that's something that's easy to let sort of slip the forefront of our consciousness, you know, like it's easy to just get so wound up and so like, you know, in whatever it is that like, I think if you can ever just stop and deliberately remember that we're supposed to enjoy this life, you know, then that might help a little bit. I think that I have more experience in addressing, you know, chemical dependency.
Yeah.
And for people who think that sobriety is going to be really boring, like, oh man, that's really, you know, like it's going to be tough. When I committed myself to recovery, I thought, man, this is going to suck, you know, like, I got to do it.
Yeah.
I didn't expect it to be fun, you know, like letting go of all my coping mechanisms, like drugs and alcohol were my tools, you know, like without them, like, I mean, I needed them. I didn't let go of something I need, you know. It's not a question whether it's going to be like boring or anything, but like, I'm going to be bare without, like, you know.
Yeah.
And, the way I have an analogy that I like to share with people who sort of have this fear of getting sober, and I compare it to and recovery in general, the work recovery. I compare recovery to a swimming pool, where most people can relate to walking up to a swimming pool and they might dunk their toe in the water, and sure enough, their toe indicates to them that that water is cold. Totally uncomfortable. I do not want to get in. And like, one would be fooling themselves to think that they're going to walk around to the shallow end and walk down the little stairs, gradually getting in. That would just be torturing yourself. No one's ever going to go all the way in that way, you know, or if they do, it's just going to be. But in fact, like as little as you want to get in there, it's going to shock your system. It's going to be cold. The way to do it, we all know, is to jump all the way into that pool. And when you land in the water, it feels cold. There's no way around it.
Right,
you know,
right.
your first thought is it shocks your system. It feels cold. But if you just jump in, and if you just stay in, like we can all relate to that thought of almost bewilderment, to be like, man, it's amazing that just a moment ago it felt so cold, but because I just stayed put, maybe paddled around a little bit, like in such a short time, I became acclimated to it. And now like I'm perfectly comfortable in this water, which just felt so cold just before.
Right.
And like, that's my experience with recovery, that I jumped in. Yeah, it would shock my system to not have my tools, you know, like, but, you know, God, it was easy to jump in that pool because I was essentially on fucking fire. I was engulfed in flames, you know, and looking back on it, what kept me in the pool was that, like, when the fog cleared enough for me to really see with some clarity what I had turned into before, like, it was pretty tough to really wrap my head around what a douche I was. Like, oh my God, I didn't want, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be that anymore. I did some really embarrassing things. Like, you know, I broadcast my downward spiral, like in real time on like MySpace and to a mass email list of like 200 of the most influential people whose contact information I had, like the most important people that I could contact. I did so on a regular basis with the most humiliating shit. And that was really mortifying. And that kind of humiliation, like, humiliated me into humility, you know, like, so in any case, the thing about, like, it's easy to jump into a pool if you're on fire, but the problem is, and I think this would be helpful for, you know, whatever group of kids you're, you know, hypothetically talking about, sure, me sharing with, that the sad truth is you can't go around shoving people into pools and expecting them to thank you for it. Right, let alone stay in. You know, you try and shove somebody into recovery, like, it's just not going to work. You know, they're going to be pissed, and you're actually going to end up pushing them away from recovery. So it's not something that you can really, like, pitch to people, or, like, you know, you can't make another person want to get well, and that's the pisser of it.
It really is, yeah.
And that's the other thing too, is that, like, it's you know, it's not water. The pool is. It's like, it's you know, a community of people. And that's what you got to jump into, a community of people. And by doing that, you're not solving the problem, trying to solve the problem alone, because you can't.
Right.
And when you are in, you know, immersed in this community of other people doing the same thing, it's like, you feel less hard done by it, because you're just doing what everybody around you is. You know?
Oh, beautifully said. And I want to say thank you for owning, like, I can't really speak to that demographic or that, you know, topic. I a lot of times see people bullshit an answer, you know, and I do the same when I'm asked in a group or a workshop a question that I don't know the answer to. I don't want to, because it's a very serious thing, obviously, that topic. I don't want to speak on it if
sure.
I don't know. So I thank you for that. I really appreciate that. And thank you for also sharing about the recovery stuff too.
And then, like, if you, you know, I don't ever try to really, you know, I don't ever try to tell people what to do. That's like the one thing, like, I'll share with them what I've done and sort of how I feel about it, but without telling anybody else what to do, because I know that you just can't, you know, push people into the pool. You can't, you know, make them want to get better if they don't want to get better on their own. Yes. They're going to do what they're going to do, and I got to let go and not be invested in the results.
Right.
But as it relates to my experience, like, now for over 12 years, I haven't wasted time getting loaded. I haven't wasted, you know, like, being loaded, like, all of the, like, bad decisions, all of the, like, lack of focus, like, you know. And then with other programs that I got into to address other, you know, problematic behaviors, you know, really, like, I've just become increasingly focused, less distracted, you know. And for the most part, like, I'm really grateful to say that I don't waste any time making bad decisions or doing things that I gotta, like, be dishonest about. You know, like, I spend basically all of my time, like, deliberately doing, like, what I not only choose to be doing, but, like, what I feel good about doing. You know, I don't lie, like, as a rule, you know, like, just, like, practice honesty, you know, like
the beginning of our conversation.
I have integrity in my relationship, you know, like, I don't have secrets, and, like, I don't have distractions, like, you know, all the running around with, you know, like, with women and sexual acting, I'm so glad that that's not my story today, you know, and that I have a relationship with a woman who I'm engaged to, who, like, I just, like, genuinely, like, I'm, you know, I view my relationship as an opportunity to express myself as the man who I aspire to be. And, like, that's something that very selfishly, like, I get to enjoy, like, you know, the feeling for the most part. I mean, of course, I screw up all the time, and, like, I'm very self-centered, and that's still an issue, you know, but for the most part, like, you know, I'm in this relationship for over 3 years. We've never said anything nasty, you know, like, because when you say something really nasty and you can't take it back, it's always going to be there.
Yeah.
And we don't have any of that, you know, like, we've never, We've never threatened the relationship where it's like, oh, I'm going to break up. I'm going to leave. You know, never once. Never even entered my mind. Like, and it was a lot of work, man. It was a lot of work for me to preemptively kind of prepare to have a healthy relationship. And, you know, that and now, and I say that because it's such a big deal. I don't have the distractions. I'm focused on what I want to be doing.
Yeah.
And not only am I not distracted, I've got a partner who helps me accomplish what I want to be accomplishing. And so the benefits of recovery are just, for me, they're so, it's just so, yeah, I feel it. It's honestly like, I feel it's almost like cheating. it's like cheating because like, it turns out that life, in my experience, it's not like necessarily that fucking difficult or complicated, you know, like if you can stop like getting in your own way and just making bad, you know, making bad decisions, getting in your own way, screwing shit up, like it's. And so I don't know. I'm really, really psyched on it. And I wish everybody would be really psyched on it. And I wish that I could tell people who are struggling, like, oh, it'll be great. You know, like you'll be psyched. Your life will get, you know.
Yeah.
But we know better than to try to, you know, impose our will on others because it doesn't work.
Yeah. And I've been on both sides of that. People trying to push me and you know, early on me trying to push other people. So I know all too well, it's very counterproductive on both ends. And then the guilt and the shame that comes up and it's, yeah, it sucks. So I am curious, cause I know you're coming up on 12 years, right?
God, March 10th, I turned 12.
Congrats, man. That's huge.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's amazing to me to see people like yourself and Randy from Lamb of God and AC from Misfits, you know, all these dudes that are in recovery and I'm not, you know, they say it publicly. So
of
it's
course.
Not. But you know, so they're people that like live these lives that can do it, you know, and all of them, I think have, since they got sober, have not relapsed, which blows my mind. It's so inspiring because I'll be honest. I was one of those people. I relapsed a number of times. And even after like literally being intubated, because I wasn't breathing anymore, you know, like I watch your stuff and I'm like, I relate wholeheartedly. And look,
how much time did you have when, like when you lost it?
It was like, 14 months the first time, 2 years the second, 3 years,
oof,
over 5 years. Oh yeah, I was the guy that, it was brutal, brutal.
I'm sorry for interrupting you jumped in there.
I appreciate you asking.
That's really fucking heavy duty, man. Like I have another analogy as it relates to, you know, putting some time together and losing that time that, I don't have the experience with it. You know, it's so once I started working a program, I've been fortunate to, you know, stay plugged in, I guess. But I've seen people, they put some time together and then they relapse.
Yeah.
And they never, it's so much harder to come back.
Yeah.
When you've had time and lost it.
Yeah.
Like I compare it to a UFC fighter who gets brutally knocked out, like their career is never the same. Like once they've been brutally knocked out, they develop, it's called a glass jaw,
yeah,
where they're prone to being knocked out now, you know, like you get knocked out and then you're prone to more knockouts,
right?
You know, and then like you gotta, like at a certain point, like you see these fighters, they get knocked out so many times, then like they can't fight anymore. But this like fight, it's something that we really need to stay in. So it's really, you want to really avoid getting knocked out, you know?
That, and like they say, cunning, baffling, you know, insidious. And it really is. Cause I did take it seriously. And aside from a program, you know, meditating, practicing mindfulness, doing everything I could do, therapy. And apparently I wasn't though, you know, cause I ended up going back. Right.
What kind of meditation do you do?
I do various kinds. Vipassana is traditionally the kind I do, just, you know, sitting, anchoring into the breath. And I like just being with my body and my feelings and my emotions. There's benefits to, I think, all of them, but it's, you know, unique to each person. So that's what I like, just sitting quietly, but I will do walking meditations. To me, I wrote about in my first book, I had a it was a meditative experience seeing Slayer one time. I was covering them for my website, and I was up there with photo passes. It was the last tour Hanneman and Lombardo did. And, you know, I'm a big Ram Dass fan. This podcast is on Ram Dass's network, and his core teaching, his mantra was, I am loving awareness. Okay, that sounds a little corny. I get it. But he taught, like, if you're doing that mantra, you begin doing it, and then the mantra does you. So you're doing it at first, and then it just becomes like second nature, like you're riding a bike. And so I do that often, and I'm doing it at the Slayer concert. And I take a second, I look around, they have the upside down crosses made out of their amps, flames, it's Slayer. And I just look around, and it's like Chris had left the building. And I just, you know, not to sound too woo, but literally a complete interconnected experience of like all beings just there in this sense of loving awareness. And for me, like, having that at a Slayer concert was big, you know, like of all places. So not to digress, like, but to me, I had that because I have a dedicated meditation practice that I try not to allow to stay on the cushion when I get off of it. That's the formal part, but then bringing it with me throughout the day, mindfulness, things of that nature. So that's how I do it. But loving kindness practices, all different kinds. Are you into meditation? That's something I was going to ask you about.
Yeah, I'm hardcore into it. I got a teacher for transcendental meditation in 2013, and I wasn't like terribly. I was on and off. You know, I was never like really totally disciplined, and I would fall off. I would get back on, and like it's crazy because like I really noticed that the benefits were there. I mean, I could really like. I mean, it's hard to describe. It's like it's somehow subtle, but it was to me undeniable that I benefited from my meditation practice. And just like confusing why when I benefit from it, I would fall off. Right. And then I became like really a little bit frustrated with myself. Like why, you know, I could get back into it. And ultimately, I got a new teacher and just refreshed, you know, like. It turns out that Vedic meditation is the same thing as transcendental meditation. Yet they're sort of warring with one another. But it's exactly the same thing. And I got a new teacher and a new mantra. I started on December 27th of last year, and I keep it all in an app. So I have.
Oh, nice.
124 days straight, averaging 41 minutes. I haven't done my second meditation today, but you know, my average, I do 20 minutes twice a day, every day.
TM.
I mean, like technically my teacher who gave me this mantra, it's Vedic.
Okay.
Yep. But yeah, it's either way, it's just mantra based meditation. And, yeah, I believe it's huge. I really believe it's huge. And I want to say too that I feel so much more comfortable, and you know, like it was just evident. Like I was just crabby when I got on the phone call or when I started talking to you, and that's totally gone away. And so apologies for being crabby when we started, and thank you for being you know, you mean, like I said, make it fun, and you know, you've made it fun.
I appreciate that.
But I'm not trying to get off either. You want to keep going? Back to you.
Thank you. Yeah, if you have a few more minutes,
of course.
You know, I know you're very busy. I appreciate it.
Let's make it an hour. I got my guy.
Well, thank you. And in the spirit of, you know, honesty, and I do want to go back to that, like. I don't get nervous when I do podcasts. I've been doing this forever. I mean, my first interview, I was in, I think, eighth, ninth grade, I interviewed Brad Wilk from Rage Against the Machine, some kid, like, you know, and ever since then, it's just, I love talking to people. But yeah, when we started, like, I'm like, oh shit, you know, I've really appreciated you pre-sobriety, post-sobriety. I was watching the CKY and Jackass stuff, when, you know, I was doing that stuff. My friends were doing the shopping carts before Jackass came out. And then we're like, we could have been making money for this shit, like, but anyways, so, you know, I was really excited about this, and, you know, I tried not to let it throw me off my game, but I'm like, oh, he's having a bad day. I felt pressure, like, but thank you, man. So yeah. I really appreciate you saying that.
I credit you with you know, bringing me down and getting me getting me more comfortable. You've made me comfortable.
Oh, I couldn't ask for anything more. Really, thank you, man.
You brought me from discomfort to unease to ease.
I will give credit to bringing it back into the body and talking about meditation, and just it naturally calms, I think. So yeah, the Vedic thing. It was funny because TM and you said the Vedic, they're like hand in hand. And also mystic Christianity, which I know people hear Christianity and a lot of people repel, understandably. But there is a mystic sect of that, like Father Thomas Keating, Thomas Merton. They have a contemplative practice that is the same thing as well, and dates back not as far as Vedic, of course, but pre-TM. And I had been practicing that about 15 years ago, and then I'd heard about TM, and you know, a lot of famous people do it, and I was kind of jaded at like, well, famous people are doing it, it's got to be bullshit. And then I did an interview with David Lynch, and he changed my mind on it. Just, you know, talking with that man and feeling that. And he's like, let my foundation have you do the training. You'll get your pass. We'll pay for it. And I'm like, okay, because that's not cheap, right? And well, for some people, it's not. And it was a really awesome experience. But when I did it, I was like, oh, I'm doing the contemplative practice from this other tradition. But I thought that was really cool how, you know, you look at some of the core teachings of the mystic aspects of these traditions, and they kind of do go hand in hand. So anyways, I just wanted to share that analogy. I thought that was really cool. And that's rad that you're doing it.
Yeah, I love it. So how much time do you have now sober?
Oh, I don't count days anymore. And here's why. What I realized, one, like you said, it just gets harder and harder. And I felt this pressure and it was shitty. You know, just unnecessary added stress. What I noticed, though, is even though I'm sober from drugs and alcohol, there are still times I go back into the same behaviors, the obsessive compulsive actions, whether it's with food or watching TV. I'm much better at it, but I'm still completely acting out on the illness, you know, like the drugs and alcohol are the symptoms. Like, we have this obsessive compulsive disorder. So I'm probably nitpicking, but I'm like, am I really sober? You know, like, yes, I'm not under the influence of something, but you know, I'm in a way getting high on sugar, or I'm, you know, just stepping out of myself. Even meditation I've used as a form of aversion. Like, you know, whereas I used to drink because I didn't want to feel, I've caught myself meditating to get out of my body. And that's not really the point of meditation, you know? So it's been a while. I know that. But yeah, I don't count anymore, just because for me, like I said, it was just, God, you know, I'm going to get 5 years again and then I'm going to fuck up again. And it is, it's very tough. And I'm lucky, as you know, to have made it back so many times, because, you know, I've lost countless friends to it. I'm sure you have too. Anyone that enters those doors, you're gonna lose people. And I've lost a lot. So I'm grateful that I'm here. And that's what I do what I do today, because, you know, that's what I feel compelled to do. So, yeah, man. But it's been a while. And I'm just grateful that I'm here to experience this day. So, man, we were on such a good riff too. And here we are. Oh, I was going to ask you, kind of randomly, and this is off topic, but you know, when I watch some of your insanity, I'm like, you know, God, how is he alive from that? You know, and how am I alive? But, and this might, I don't mean to sound morbid, but maybe you'll have fun with this. How would you want to die? Is there a way like you would want to go out?
I always said on an airplane, in an airplane crash, and the philosophy behind that was that at a certain point, you would know that the plane was going down, and you wouldn't have so much time to dwell on it, or, you know, like, but you would have enough time to deliberately think your last thought. And the adrenaline of all of it going down might like really seem to like override, like, you know, just like the adrenaline, like, ah, you know, and then when it did crash, it seems like it would be such an instant death, you know, and you know, I mean, it wouldn't. So, but then again, I think that was like philosophically, I think it's you know, pretty strong argument for a good way to die. I don't think anybody wants to die.
No, right.
I think whatever is just kind of painless and, you know, like doesn't involve suffering, I think is a good aspiration, you know. Well, actually, you know what? How about this? And I could go on a real fucking tirade right here. I could really go on a tirade. I actually went on one with my girl. We were watching. We watched the series Don't Fuck With Cats.
Oh, yeah.
And what a fucking incredible show.
Yeah.
A three-part series. Man, we didn't want, we would love animals. We didn't want to, we resisted watching it, but it was recommended enough and strongly recommended enough that we just, you know, we just, they said just power through it. It's going to be worth it.
Yeah.
So we did. And I think that might be the best three-part series, any series.
Yeah.
That's the, did you watch it?
Oh, I did. And I had to power through it too. I know a lot of people that couldn't,
right.
And I understand why, but incredible.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It was good. And then at the end, when it ended, my girl said, I know the death penalty is, you know, a weird thing, but like, there's some people that just shouldn't be around it. And this guy, she suggested that this guy should be executed. And I said, no, like, and the reason I bring this up is because actually it did occur to me the best way to die is lethal injection.
Ah.
100%, the most painless, the most easy, like, and it's just to me, like, the, I'm going to give you my little tirade here about the reason why. The reason why the death penalty is just offensively wrong is that there's a bunch of reasons, but the main one is that to execute someone, you know, in the criminal justice system costs at least 10 times the amount of taxpayer money as it would cost to let them live into, you know, past the age of 100 and die of natural causes, feeding them and housing them the whole time.
Yeah.
The reason for that is that by the time you actually execute someone, you have to have exhausted the appeals process. And the appeals process for execution goes all the way up through the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So it is impossible to kill a prisoner, to execute a prisoner without generating so much in court costs that it's just 10 times more expensive to do so. It's just not economically prudent to spend that much money over this, like, vengeful, you know, like, you know, and then for that matter, that when you do that, like, I had an experience when I was just about 20. I was on the cusp of my 27th birthday. I was in Mexico doing cocaine all night long. And I was by myself just doing cocaine. And I'm watching TV until the sun came up in the morning. On every channel that had English in Mexico,
yeah.
every English-speaking channel was like minute-to-minute coverage of the execution of the Oklahoma City bomber, Timothy McVeigh. Yeah. And now they gave him his choice of a last meal. He ate two tubs of mint chocolate chip ice cream, like however big a tub is. He ate them both in their entirety. And that's neither here nor there, but okay. Like, the fact that I know that is what's alarming, okay?
Yeah.
So then he goes into the death chamber, and the death chamber has like three rooms surrounding it, right? The death chamber's in the middle, and each room has a one-way mirror glass, right? So that the people in, you know, can view the death chamber, but from the death chamber, he can't view it. So there's one that's for government officials. There's one for like members of the media, and there's one for like family members of victims. And, you know, it's the three. And he comes into the death chamber. They described that he walked in and he like squinted at each like one-way mirror, you know, like each window, like trying to look through and like that, you know, like gave some like disrespectful scoff at the people behind it and like they asked him what his last words were. You know, he gets to say his last words, and he actually wrote down his last words and handed the page over to some government official who read them out loud. And it was just so offensive to me that this taxpayer dollars, you know, the government official was paying to read, where it was like, just, I am the master of my own domain, you know, like whatever. Like, it was just this like super arrogant, like unapologetic, no remorse, like just shitheaded last words that he had the government official read. And I'm watching it. It's on every English speaking channel. It's minute to minute coverage. There's crowds outside the jail. Ah, this guy was the most famous dude on the planet, like, at that time. And then this was his only bet. This guy was like, either be a loser that nobody knows, or like a loser that everybody, you know, like, this guy elected, he chose infamy over obscurity. And in this infamy, we made him the most notorious character in the world that day. All the attention, he was loving it.
Yeah.
Just love, just gave him exactly what he wanted. And then when it actually came time to execute the dude, like, he like did not even think he blinked. Blinked. Like, he like, it was, you know, because the actual lethal injection process, they give you three drugs. The first one's an anesthesia, general anesthesia. So you're out before. And the next one's like a muscle, something or other. And then the third one stops your heart. But you don't even remember this guy didn't even blink. You know, so in my mind, to be a family member of the victim, you know, to be in there and be like, I just want to watch this guy die. You know, to have that vengefulness, you know, which that resentment and that to be like so vindictive. I just want to see him like there's no vindication in that. There's no, like, it was just like, I imagine to seek vengeance, to go see this guy die. I would just imagine that would have been the worst, to see this guy. Where in my view, like, everybody knows about hospitals and where, you know, there's a big H, you know, a hospital this way, you know, they're marked. There is no sign indicating where the hospice is. But as I understand it, there are more people, there are more hospices, there are more people in hospices. A lot of people don't even know what the word hospice means. It's where people go because they're terminal and they're not going to get better. It's where you just go out to live out your last days and hopefully in some kind of comfort. Yeah. But in my estimation, I think that hospices are all over the country, all over the world, filled with people who are genuinely suffering, like truly agonizing pain and suffering, who would just be begging, who probably are begging for a way out, you know, for a merciful ending, but they're not allowed to get it. They're not allowed. Like, it is illegal to euthanize humans. Right. And like all these people suffering, they would be begging to have the cakewalk, easy death that this terrorist, McVeigh, they would beg for the easy death that he got, the painless death, but they're not allowed to have it, and yet we give it to the terrorist who killed all these women and children, hundreds of people. And we made him the most famous guy on the planet while he enjoyed this cakewalk of a death. And it cost us 10 times the amount of money.
Wow. I'm glad we went down that road.
Yeah, see, that's how I want to die. I want lethal injection.
All that to say, I'm like, I shouldn't ask that, but now I'm glad I did.
This fucking airplane crash theory. Fuck that. Fucking air crash. I'll think my last thought deliberately. You know.
Have
you? I'll say my last words, and then and I won't even blink. I'll just be like, it's like going in for surgery without the pesky waking up sore.
I love it.
Yeah.
Lethal injection. Well, man, thank you so much. I know we're right out at the hour mark.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, man.
Thanks. I really appreciate it. I know you're busy.
For For those who aren't aware, I have my own podcast now. I just started,
which is awesome. Yep.
It's called Wild Ride with Steve-O. And yeah, man, I'm glad we got to do this. And again, thank you for you made my irritability go away, man. And I'm not normally like that. I'm really not like, just remember we were like shooting this thing, and I'm like, fuck, I'm gonna do this,
Well, and
it is what it is, man. It's been a pleasure, and thank you for having me on.
I appreciate it. I did want to say quickly, I did want to plug that podcast. It's awesome. You've had Wee Man, you've had Dr. Drew, like a bunch of great shows. What do you have, like 4 or 5 episodes out now, something like that?
Yeah, there's a number 6 drops tomorrow. It's Demi Lovato.
Oh.
All yeah. Right.
Looking forward to that. Hawk was your first episode, I think.
Hawk.
So just check out Steve-O on YouTube and the podcast anywhere podcasts can be found. And lastly, I know that you are doing the Bucket List tour, which COVID obviously has stopped everything in its tracks. Are you planning on picking that back up when we have some semblance of what we're doing?
Whenever it's okay to do a show, I'm ready to put it on.
Awesome. I'm sure you are. Steve-O, your website, steveo.com. I should have checked. I'm sorry, man.
It's fine. It's all good. Yeah, steveo.com. I'm all easy. Cool.
All right, man. All right. Thank you for everything. Be well, sir.
Of course, you too.
Take care. Thanks. Bye.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.